Well, sir, Colonel Giusti said, I think the cavalry squadron is in pretty good shape. Like Diggs, Angelo Giusti was a career cavalryman. His job as commander of 1st Armored Cavalry Squadron, actually a battalion, but the Cav had its own way of speaking, was to move out ahead of the division proper, locating the enemy and scouting out the land, being the eyes of Old Ironsides, but with enough combat power of its own to look after itself. A combat veteran of the Persian Gulf War, Giusti had smelled the smoke and seen the elephant. He knew what his job was, and he figured he had his troopers trained up about as well as circumstances in Germany allowed. He actually preferred the free-form play allowed by simulators to the crowded training fields of the Combat Maneuver Training Center, which was barely 75 square kilometers. It wasn't the same as being out there in your vehicles, but neither was it restricted by time and distance. And on the global SimNet system, you could play against a complete enemy battalion. Even a brigade if you wanted your people to get some sweat in their play. Except for the bumpy float sensation of driving your Abrams around, some tankers got motion sickness from that, it conveyed the complexity better than any place except the NTC at Fort Irwin in the California desert, or the comparable facility the Army had established for the Israelis in the Negev. Diggs couldn't quite read the younger officer's mind, but he'd just watched the quarter horse move around with no lack of skill. They'd played against some Germans, and the Germans, as always, were pretty good at the war business. But not today as good as 1st Tank's cavalry troopers, who'd first outmaneuvered their European hosts, and then, to the surprise and distaste of the German brigadier who'd supervised the exercise, set an ambush that had cost them half a battalion of their Leos, as the Americans called the Leopard 2 main battle tanks. Diggs would be having dinner with the brigadier later today. Even the Germans didn't know night fighting as well as the Americans did, which was odd since their equipment was roughly comparable, and their soldiers pretty well trained. But the German army was still largely a conscript army, most of whose soldiers didn't have the time in service the Americans enjoyed. In the wider exercise, the cavalry part had just been the real segment of a wider command post exercise, or CPX. Colonel Don Lyle's 2nd Brigade was handling the fuller, if theoretical, German attack quite capably. On the whole, the Bundeswehr was not having a good day. Well, it no longer had the mission of protecting its country against a Soviet invasion, and with that had gone the rather furious support of the citizenry that the West German Army had enjoyed for so many years. Now the Bundeswehr was an anachronism with little obvious purpose, and the occupier of a lot of valuable real estate for which Germans could think up some practical uses. And so the former West German Army had been downsized and mainly trained to do peacekeeping duty, which, when you got down to it, was heavily armed police work. The New World Order was a peaceful one, at least so far as Europeans were concerned. The Americans had engaged in combat operations to the rather distant interest of the Germans, who, while they'd always had a healthy interest in war fighting, were now happy enough that their interest in it was entirely theoretical, rather like a particularly intricate Hollywood production. It also forced them to respect America a little more than they would have preferred, but some things couldn't be helped. "Well, Angelo, I think your troopers have earned themselves a beer or two at the local gas houses. That envelopment you accomplished at 0220 was particularly adroit." Giusti grinned and nodded his appreciation. "Thank you, General. I'll pass that one along to my S3. He's the one who thought it up." "Later, Angelo." "Roger that one, sir." Lieutenant Colonel Giusti saluted his divisional commander on his way. "Well, Duke?" Colonel Masterman pulled a cigar out of his BDU jacket and lit it up. One nice thing about Germany was that you could always get good Cuban ones here. "I've known Angelo since Fort Knox. He knows his stuff, and he had his officers particularly well trained. Even had his own book on tactics and battle drill printed up."
"Oh?" Diggs turned. "Is it any good?"
"Not bad at all," the G3 replied.
"I'm not sure that I agree with it all, but It doesn't hurt to have everyone singing out of the same hymnal. His officers all think pretty much the same way. So Angelo's a good football coach. Sure enough, he kicked the Krauts' asses last night. Masterman closed his eyes and rubbed his face. These night exercises take it out of you. How's Lyle doing?
Sir, last time I looked, he had the Germans well contained. Our friends didn't seem to know what he had around them.
They were putzing around trying to gather information. Short version, Giusti won the reconnaissance battle, and that decided things. Again.
Again, Diggs agreed.
If there was any lesson out of the National Training Center, it was that one. Reconnaissance and counter-reconnaissance. Find the enemy. Don't let the enemy find you. If you pulled that off, it was pretty hard to lose. If you didn't, it was very hard to win. How's some sleep grab you, Duke?
It's good to have a CG who looks after his troopers, mon général.
Masterman was sufficiently tired that he didn't even want a beer first. And so, with that decided, they headed for Diggs's command UH-60 Blackhawk helicopter for the hop back to the divisional caserne. Diggs particularly liked the 4-point safety belt. It made it a lot easier to sleep sitting up. One of the things I have to do today, Ryan told himself, is figure out what to do about the Chinese attempt on Sergei. He checked his daily briefing sheet. Robbie was out west again. That was too bad. Robbie was both a good sounding board and a source of good ideas. So he'd talk it over with Scott Adler, if he and Scott both had holes in their day, and the Foleys. Who else? Jack wondered. Damn, whom else could he trust with this? If this one leaked to the press, there'd be hell to pay. Okay, Adler had to be there. He'd actually met that Zhang guy. And if some Chinese minister type had owned a piece of this, then he'd be the one, wouldn't he?
Probably.
Not certainly, however. Ryan had been in the spook business too long to make that mistake. When you made certainty assumptions about things you weren't really sure about, you frequently walked right into a stone wall head first, and that could hurt. Ryan punched a button on his desk.
Ellen?
Yes, Mr. President?
Later today I need Scott Adler and the Foleys in here. It'll take about an hour. Find me a hole in the schedule, will you?
About 2:30, but it means putting off the Secretary of Transportation's meeting about the air traffic control proposals.
Make it so, Ellen. This one's important, he told her.
Yes, Mr. President.
It was by no means perfect. Ryan preferred to work on things as they popped into his mind. But as president, you quickly learned that you served the schedule, not the other way around. Jack grimaced. So much for the illusion of power. Mary Pat Foley strolled into her office, as she did nearly every morning, and as always turned on her computer. If there was one thing she'd learned from Zorga, it was to turn the damn thing all the way off when she wasn't using it. There was a further switch on her phone line that manually blocked it, much as if she'd pulled the plug out of the wall. She flipped that, too. It was an old story for an employee of an intelligence service. Sure, she was paranoid, but was she paranoid enough? Sure enough, there was another email from seagood@jadecastle.com. Chet Nomori was still at work, and this download took a mere 23 seconds. With the download complete, she made sure she'd backed it up, then clobbered it out of her inbox so that no copies remained even in the ether world. Next, she printed it all up and called down for Joshua Sears to do the translations and some seat-of-the-pants analysis. Zorga had become routine in handling, if not in importance, and by 8:45 she had the translation in hand.
"Oh, Lord, Jack's just going to love this one," the DDO observed at her desk.
Then she walked the document to Ed's larger office facing the woods. That's when she found out about the afternoon trip to the White House. Mary Abbott was the official White House makeup artist. It was her job to make the president look good on TV,
which meant making him look like a cheap whore in person, but that couldn't be helped. Ryan had learned not to fidget too much, which made her job easier. But she knew he was fighting the urge, which both amused and concerned her.
"How's your son doing at school?" Ryan asked.
"Just fine, thank you. And there's a nice girl he's interested in." Ryan didn't comment on that. He knew that there had to be some boy or boys at St. Mary's who found his Sally highly interesting. She was pretty, even to disinterested eyes, but he didn't want to think about that. It did make him grateful for the Secret Service, however. Whenever Sally went on a date, there would be at least a chase car full of armed agents close by, and that would take the starch out of most teenage boys. So the USSS did have its uses, eh? Girl children, Jack thought, were God's punishment on you for being a man. His eyes were scanning his briefing sheets for the mini-press conference, the likely questions and the better sorts of answers to give to them. It seemed very dishonest to do it this way, but some foreign heads of government had the question pre-screened so that the answers could be properly canned. Not a bad idea in the abstract, Jack thought, but the American media would spring for that about as quickly as a coyote would chase after a whale.
"There," Mrs. Abbott said, as she finished touching up his hair.
Ryan stood, looked in the mirror, and grimaced as usual.
"Thank you, Mary," he managed to say.
"You're welcome, Mr. President."
And Ryan walked out, crossing the hall from the Roosevelt Room to the Oval Office, where the TV equipment was set up. The reporters stood when he entered, as the kids at St. Matthew's had stood when the priest came into class. But in third grade, the kids asked easier questions. Jack sat down in a rocking swivel chair. Kennedy had done something similar to that, and Arnie thought it a good idea for Jack as well. The gentle rocking that a man did unconsciously in the chair gave him a homey look, the spin experts all thought. Jack didn't know that, and knowing it would have caused him to toss the chair out the window. But Arnie did, and he'd eased the president into it merely by saying it looked good, and getting Kathy Ryan to agree. In any case, Swordsman sat down and relaxed in the comfortable chair, which was the other reason Arnie had foisted it on him, and the real reason why Ryan had agreed. It was comfortable.
"We ready?" Jack asked.
When the president asked that, it usually meant, "Let's get this fucking show on the road." But Ryan thought it was just a question. Kristen Matthews was there to represent NBC. There were also reporters from ABC and Fox, plus a print reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Ryan had come to prefer these more intimate press conferences, and the media went along with it because the reporters were assigned by lot, which made it fair, and everyone had access to the questions and answers. The other good thing, from Ryan's perspective, was that a reporter was less likely to be confrontational in the Oval Office than in the raucous locker room atmosphere of the press room, where the reporters tended to bunch together in a mob and adopt a mob mentality.
"Mr. President," Kristen Matthews began, "you've recalled both the trade delegation and our ambassador from Beijing. Why was that necessary?"
Ryan rocked a little in the chair.
"Kristen, we all saw the events in Beijing that so grabbed the conscience of the world, the murder of the cardinal and the minister, followed by the roughing up, to use a charitable term for it, of the minister's widow and some members of the congregation." He went on to repeat the points he'd made in his previous press conference, making particular note of the Chinese government's indifference to what had happened. "One can only conclude that the Chinese government doesn't care." "Well, we care. The American people care. And this administration cares. You cannot take the life of a human being as casually as though you are swatting an insect. The response we received was unsatisfactory, and so I recalled our ambassador for consultations."
"But the trade negotiations, Mr. President," the Chicago Tribune broke in. It is difficult for a country like the United States of America to do business with a nation which does not recognize human rights. You've seen for yourself what our citizens think of all this. I believe you will find that they find those murders as repellent as I do, and, I would imagine, as you do yourself. And so you will not recommend to Congress that we normalize trading relations with China?
Ryan shook his head.
No, I will not so recommend, and even if I did, Congress would rightly reject such a recommendation.
At what time might you change your position on this issue?
At such time as China enters the world of civilized nations and recognizes the rights of its common people, as all other great nations do.
So you are saying that China today is not a civilized country?
Ryan felt as though he'd been slapped across the face with a cold, wet fish. But he smiled and went on.
Killing diplomats is not a civilized act, is it?
What will the Chinese think of that? Fox asked.
I cannot read their minds.
I do call upon them to make amends, or at least to consider the feelings and beliefs of the rest of the world, and then to consider their unfortunate action in that light.
And what about the trade issues? This one came from ABC.
If China wants normalized trade relations with the United States, then China will have to open its markets to us. As you know, we have a law on the books here called the Trade Reform Act. That law allows us to mirror image other countries' trade laws and practices, so that whatever tactics are used against us, we can then use those very same tactics with respect to trade with them. Tomorrow I will direct the Department of State and the Department of Commerce to set up a working group to implement TRA with respect to the People's Republic, President Ryan announced, making the story for the day. And a bombshell it was.
Christ, Jack, the Secretary of the Treasury said in his office across the street. He was getting a live feed from the Oval Office. He lifted his desk phone and punched a button.
I want a read of the PRC's current cash accounts global, he told one of his subordinates from New York. Then his phone rang.
Secretary of State on three, his secretary told him over the intercom.
Sec-Trez grunted and picked up the phone.
Yeah, I saw it too, Scott.
So, Yuri Andreevich, how'd it go?
Clark asked.
It had taken over a week to set up, and mainly because General Karelin had spent a few hours on the pistol range working on his technique. Now he'd just stormed into the officers' club bar, looking as though he'd taken one in the guts.
Is he a mafia assassin?
Chavez had himself a good laugh at that.
General, he came to us because the Italian police wanted to get him away from the mafia. He got in the way of a mob assassination, and the local chieftain made noises about going after him and his family.
What did he get you for?
50 euros, Karelin nearly spat.
You were confident going in, eh? Clark asked. Been there, done that.
Got the fucking T-shirt, Ding finished the statement with a laugh.
And 50 euros was a dent even in the salary of a Russian three-star.
3 points in a 500-point match. I scored 493.
Ettore only got 496, Clark asked.
Jesus, the boy's slowing down.
He slid a glass in front of the Russian general officer.
He's drinking more over here, Chavez observed.
That must be it, Clark nodded.
The Russian general officer was not, however, the least bit amused.
Falcone is not human, Karelin said, gunning down his first shot of vodka. He could scare Wild Bill Hickok, and that's a fact.
And you know the worst part about it?
What is that, Ivan Sergeyevich?
He's so goddamned humble about it, like it's fucking normal to shoot like that.
Jesus, Sam Snead was never that good with a five-iron.
General, Domingo said after his second vodka of the evening, the problem with being in Russia was that you tended to pick up the local customs, and one of those was drinking. Every man on my team is an expert shot, and by expert I mean close to being on his country's Olympic team, okay?
Big Bird's got us all beat, and none of us are used to losing any more'n you are. But I'll tell you, I'm goddamn glad he's on my team."
Just then, Falcone walked through the door.
"Hey, Ettore, come on over."
He hadn't gotten any shorter. Ettore towered over the diminutive Chavez, and still looked like a figure from an El Greco painting.
"General," he said in greeting to Karelin, "you shoot extremely well."
"Not so good as you, Falcone," the Russian responded.
The Italian cop shrugged.
"I had a lucky day."
"Sure, guy," Clark reacted, as he handed Falcone a shot glass.
"I've come to like this vodka," Falcone said on gunning it down, "but it affects my aim somewhat."
"Yeah, Ettore," Chavez chuckled. "The general told us you blew 4 points in the match."
"You mean you have done better than this?" Karelin demanded.
"He has," Clark answered. "I watched him shoot a possible 3 weeks ago. That was 500 points, too."
"That was a good day," Falcone agreed. "I had a good night's sleep beforehand and no hangover at all."
Clark had himself a good chuckle and turned to look around the room. Just then another uniform entered the room and looked around. He spotted General Karelin and walked over.
"Damn, who's this recruiting poster?" Ding wondered aloud as he approached.
"Tovarish General," the man said by way of greeting.
"Anatoly Ivanich," Karelin responded. "How are things at the center?"
Then the guy turned.
"You are John Clark?"
"That's me," the American confirmed. "Who are you?"
"Oh, this is Major Anatoly Shalepin," General Karelin answered. "He's chief of personal security for Sergei Golovko."
"We know your boss."
Ding held out his hand.
"Howdy, I'm Domingo Chavez."
Handshakes were exchanged all around.
"Could we speak in a quieter place?" Shalepin asked.
The four men took over a corner booth in the club. Falcone remained at the bar.
"Sergei Nikolaevich sent you over?" the Russian general asked.
"You haven't heard," Major Shalepin answered.
It was the way he said it that got everyone's attention. He spoke in Russian, which Clark and Chavez understood well enough.
"I want my people to train with you."
"Haven't heard what?" Karelin asked.
"We found out who tried to kill the chairman," Shalepin answered.
"Oh, he was the target? I thought they were after the pimp," Karelin objected.
"You guys want to tell us what you're talking about?" Clark asked.
"A few weeks ago there was an assassination attempt in Dzerzhinsky Square," Shalepin responded, explaining what they'd thought at the time. "But now it appears they hit the wrong target."
"Somebody tried to waste Golovko?" Domingo asked. "Damn."
"Who was it?"
"The man who arranged it was a former KGB officer named Suvorov, so we believe, that is. He used 2 ex-Spetsnaz soldiers. They have both been murdered, probably to conceal their involvement, or at least to prevent them from discussing it with anyone."
Shalepin didn't add anything else.
"In any case, we have heard good things about your rainbow troops, and we want you to help train my protective detail."
"It's okay with me, so long as it's okay with Washington."
Clark stared hard into the bodyguard's eyes. He looked damn serious, but not very happy with the world at the moment.
"We will make the formal request tomorrow."
"They are excellent, these rainbow people," Karelin assured him. "We are getting along well with them. Anatoly used to work for me back when I was a colonel."
The tone of voice told what he thought of the younger man. There was more to this, Clark thought. A senior Russian official didn't just ask a former CIA officer for help with something related to his personal safety out of the clear blue. He caught Ding's eye and saw the same thought. Suddenly, both were back in the spook business.
"Okay," John said. "I'll call home tonight if you want."
He'd do that from the American Embassy, probably on the Stew 6 in the station chief's office.
Chapter 37 Fallout. The VC-137 landed without fanfare at Andrews Air Force Base. The base lacked a proper terminal and the attendant jetways, and so the passengers debarked on stairs grafted onto a flatbed truck. Cars waited at the bottom to take them into Washington. Mark Gant was met by two Secret Service agents who drove him at once to the Treasury Department building across the street from the White House. He'd barely gotten used to being on the ground when he found himself in the Secretary's office. "How'd it go?" George Winston asked. "Interesting, to say the least," Gant said, his mind trying to get used to the fact that his body didn't have a clue where it was at the moment. "I thought I'd be going home to sleep it off." "Ryan's invoking the Trade Recovery Act against the Chinese." "Oh, well, that's not all that much of a surprise, is it?" "Look at this," Sectrez commanded, handing over a recently produced printout. This was a report on the current cash holdings of the People's Republic of China. "How solid is this information?" Telescope asked Trader. The report was an intelligence estimate in all but name. Employees within the Treasury Department routinely kept track of international monetary transactions as a means of determining the day-to-day strength of the dollar and other internationally traded currencies. That included the Chinese yuan, which had been having a slightly bad time of late. "They're this thin?" Gant asked. "I thought they were running short of cash, but I didn't know it was quite this bad." "It surprised me, too," Sectrez admitted. "It appears that they've been purchasing a lot of things on the international market lately, especially jet engines from France, and because they're late paying for the last round, the French company has decided to take a harder line. They're the only game in town. We won't let GE or Pratt & Whitney bid on the order, and the Brits have similarly forbidden Rolls-Royce. That makes the French the sole source. Which isn't so bad for the French, is it? They've jacked up the price about 15%, and they're asking for cash up front." "The yuan's going to take a hit," Gant predicted. "They've been trying to cover this up, eh?" "Yeah, and fairly successfully." "That's why they were hitting us so hard on the trade deal. They saw this one coming, and they wanted a favorable announcement to bail them out. But they sure didn't play it very smart. Damn, you have this sort of a problem, you learn to crawl a little."
"I thought so, too. Why do you think?"
"They're proud, George. Very, very proud. Like a rich family that's lost its money but not its social position, and tries to make up for the one with the other. But it doesn't work. Sooner or later, people find out that you're not paying your bills, and then the whole world comes crashing in on you. You can put it off for a while, which makes sense if you have something coming in. But if the ship don't dock, you sink."
Gant flipped some pages, thinking, "The other problem is that countries are run by politicians, people with no real understanding of money, who figure they can always maneuver their way out of whatever comes up. They're so used to having their own way that they never really think they can't have it that way all the time." One of the things Gant had learned working in D.C. was that politics was just as much about illusion as the motion picture business was, which perhaps explained the affinity the two communities had for each other. But even in Hollywood you had to pay the bills, and you had to show a profit. Politicians always had the option of using T-bills to finance their accounts, and they also printed the money. Nobody expected the government to show a profit. And the board of directors was the voters, the people whom politicians conned as a way of life. It was all crazy, but that was the political game. "That's probably what the PRC leaders were thinking," Gant surmised. But sooner or later, reality raised its ugly head. And when it did, all the time spent trying to avoid it was what really bit you on the ass. That was when the whole world said, "Gotcha." And then you were well and truly got. In this case, the gotcha could be the collapse of the Chinese economy, and it would happen virtually overnight. "George, I think state and CIA need to see this, and the president, too."
Lord.
The president was sitting in the Oval Office, smoking one of Ellen Sumter's Virginia Slims and watching TV. This time it was C-SPAN. Members of the United States House of Representatives were speaking in the well about China. The content of the speeches was not complimentary, and the tone was decidedly inflammatory. All were speaking in favor of a resolution to condemn the People's Republic of China. C-SPAN, too, was covering much the same verbiage in the Senate. Though the language was a touch milder, the import of the words was not. Labor unions were united with churches, liberals with conservatives, even free traders with protectionists. More to the point, CNN and the other networks showed demonstrations in the streets, and it appeared that Taiwan's We're the Good Guys campaign had taken hold. Somebody, nobody was sure who yet, had even printed up stickers of the red Chinese flag with the caption, "We kill babies and ministers." They were being attached to products imported from China. And the protesters were also busy identifying the American firms that did a lot of business on the Chinese mainland, with the aim of boycotting them. Ryan's head turned. "Talk to me, Arnie."
"This looks serious, Jack," Van Damme said. "Gee, Arnie, I can see that.
How serious?"
"Enough that I'd sell stock in those companies. They're going to take a hit. And this movement may have legs."
"What?"
"I mean, it might not go away real soon. Next, you're going to see posters with stills from the TV coverage of those two clerics being murdered. That's an image that doesn't go away. If there's any product the Chinese sell here that we can get elsewhere, then a lot of Americans will start buying it elsewhere."
The picture on CNN changed to live coverage of a demonstration outside the PRC embassy in Washington. The signs said things like, "Murderers, killers, and barbarians."
"I wonder if Taiwan is helping to organize this."
"Probably not. At least not yet," Van Damme thought.
"If I were they, I wouldn't exactly mind, but I wouldn't need to play with this.
They'll probably increase their efforts to distinguish themselves from the mainland, and that amounts to the same thing. Look for the networks to do stories about the Republic of China, and how upset they are with all this crap in Beijing, how they don't want to be tarred with the same brush and all that," the chief of staff said.
"You know, yes, we are Chinese, but we believe in human rights and freedom of religion, that sort of thing.
It's the smart move. They have some good PR advisors here in D.C. Hell, I probably know some of them, and if I were on the payroll, that's what I would advise." That's when the phone rang. It was Ryan's private line, the one that usually bypassed the secretaries. Jack lifted it.
"Yeah?"
"Jack, it's George across the street. Got a minute? I want to show you something, buddy."
"Sure, come on over."
Jack hung up and turned to Arnie.
"Sec Trez," he explained, "says it's important."
The president paused.
"Arnie?"
"Yeah?"
"How much maneuvering room do I have with this?"
"The Chinese?" Arnie asked, getting a nod.
"Not a hell of a lot, Jack. Sometimes the people themselves decide what our policy is. And the people will be making policy now by voting with their pocketbooks. Next, we'll see some companies announce that they're suspending their commercial contracts with the PRC. The Chinese already fucked Boeing over, and in the full light of day, which wasn't real smart. Now the people out there will want to fuck them back. You know, there are times when the average Joe citizen stands up on his hind feet and gives the world a finger. When that happens, it's your job mainly to follow them, not to lead them," the chief of staff concluded. His Secret Service code name was Carpenter, and he'd just constructed a box for his president to stay inside. Jack nodded and stubbed out the smoke. He might be the most powerful man in the world, but his power came from the people, and as it was theirs to give, it was also sometimes theirs to exercise. Few people could simply open the door to the Oval Office and walk in. But George Winston was one of them, mainly because the Secret Service belonged to him. Mark Gant was with him, looking as though he'd just run a marathon chased by a dozen armed and angry Marines in jeeps.
"Hey, Jack."
"George."
"Mark, you look like hell," Ryan said. "Oh, you just flew in, didn't you?"
"Is this Washington or Shanghai?" Gant offered, as rather a wan joke.
"We took the tunnel. Jesus, have you seen the demonstrators outside?"
"I think they want you to nuke Beijing," Sectrez observed. The president just pointed at his bank of television sets by way of an answer.
"Hell, why are they demonstrating here?"
"I'm on their side.
At least I think I am.
Anyway, what brings you over?"
"Check this out." Winston nodded to Gant.
"Mr. President, these are the PRC's current currency accounts. We keep tabs on currency trading worldwide to make sure we know where the dollar is, which means we pretty much know where all the hard currency is in the world."
"Okay."
Ryan knew about that, sort of. He didn't worry much about it since the dollar was in pretty good shape, and the non-squeaky wheel didn't need any grease.
"So?"
"So the PRC's liquidity situation is in the shitter," Gant reported. "Maybe that's why they were so pushy in the trade talks. If so, they picked the wrong way to approach us. They demanded instead of asked."
Ryan looked down the columns of numbers.
"Damn, where have they been dumping all their money?"
"Buying military hardware, France and Russia mostly, but a lot went to Israel, too."
It was not widely known that the PRC had spent a considerable sum of money in Israel, mainly paid to IDI, Israel Defense Industries, to buy American-designed hardware manufactured under license in Israel. It was stuff the Chinese could not purchase directly from America, including guns for their tanks and air-to-air missiles for their fighter aircraft. America had winked at the transactions for years. In conducting this business, Israel had turned its back on Taiwan, despite the fact that both countries had produced their nuclear weapons as a joint venture, back when they'd stuck together, along with South Africa, as international pariahs with no other friends in that particular area. In polite company, it was called Realpolitik. In other areas of human activity, it was called Fuck Your Buddy.
"And?" Ryan asked.
"And they've spent their entire trade surplus this way," Gant reported. "All of it, mainly on short-term purchase items, but some long-term as well. And for the long-term stuff, they had to pay cash up front because of the nature of the transactions. The producers need the cash to run the production, and they don't want to get stuck holding the bag. Not too many people need 5,000 tank guns," Gant explained. "The market is kinda exclusive."
"So?"
"So China is essentially out of cash. And they have real short-term cash needs, like oil," Telescope went on. "China's a net importer of oil. Production in their domestic fields falls well short, even though their needs are not really that great. Not too many Chinese citizens own cars. They have enough cash for 3 months' worth of oil, and then they come up short. The international oil market demands prompt payment. They can skate for a month, maybe 6 weeks. But after that, the tankers will turn around in mid-ocean and go somewhere else. They can do that, you know. And then the PRC runs out. It'll be like running into a wall, sir. Smack. No more oil. And then their country starts coming to a stop, including their military, which is their largest oil consumer. They've been running unusually high for some years because of increased activity in their maneuvers and training and stuff. They probably have strategic reserves, but we don't know exactly how much. And that can run out, too. We've been expecting them to make a move on the Spratly Islands. There's oil there, and they've been making noises about it off and on for about 10 years. But the Philippines and other countries in the area have made claims, too. And they probably expect us to side with the Philippines for historical reasons. Not to mention, Seventh Fleet is still the biggest kid on the block in that part of the world."
"Yeah," Ryan nodded.
"If it came to a showdown, the Philippines appear to have the best claim on the islands, and we would back them up. We've shed blood together in the past, and that counts.
Go on."
"So, John Chinaman is short of oil, and he may not have the cash to pay for it, especially if our trade with them goes down the toilet. They need our dollars. The yuan isn't very strong anyway. International trading is also done in dollars. And as I just told you, sir, they've spent most of them.
What are you telling me?
Sir, the PRC is just about bankrupt. In a month or so, they're going to find that out, and it's going to be a bit of a shock for them.
When did we find this out?
Oh, that's my doing, Jack, the Secretary of the Treasury said. I called up these documents earlier today, and then I had Mark go over them. He's our best man for economic modeling, even whacked out with jet lag.
So we can squeeze them on this?
Well, that's one option.
What if these demonstrations take hold?
Gant and Winston shrugged simultaneously.
That's where psychology enters into the equation, said Winston. We can predict it to some extent on Wall Street. That's how I made most of my money. But psychoanalyzing a country is beyond my ken. That's your job, pal. I just run your accounting office across the street.
I need more than that, George.
Another shrug.
If the average citizen boycotts Chinese goods, and or if American companies who do business over there start trimming their sales...
That's damned likely, Gant interjected.
This has got to have a lot of CEOs shitting their pants.
Well, if that happens, the Chinese get one in the guts, and it's going to hurt big time, Trader concluded.
And how will they react to that, Ryan wondered. He punched his phone button.
Ellen, I need one.
His secretary appeared in a flash and handed him a cigarette. Ryan lit it and thanked her with a smile and a nod.
Have you talked this one over with State yet?
A shake of the head.
No, wanted to show it to you first.
Mark, what did you make of the negotiations?
They're the most arrogant sons of bitches I've ever seen. I mean, I've met all sorts of big shots in my time, movers and shakers. But even the worst of them know when they need my money to do business, and when they know that, their manners get better. When you shoot a gun, you try to make sure you don't have it aimed at your own dick.
That made Ryan laugh, while Arnie cringed.
You weren't supposed to talk that way to the President of the United States, but some of these people knew that you could talk that way to John Patrick Ryan, the man.
By the way, along those lines, I liked what you told that Chinese diplomat.
What's that, sir?
Their dicks aren't big enough to get in a pissing contest with us. Nice turn of phrase, if not exactly diplomatic.
How did you know that? Gant asked, the surprise showing on his face.
I never repeated that to anybody, not even to that jerk Rutledge.
Oh, we have ways, Jack answered, suddenly realizing that he'd revealed something from a compartment named Zorga.
Oops.
Sounds like something you say at the New York Athletic Club, Sectrez observed. But only if you're 4 feet or so away from the guy.
But it appears it's true, at least in monetary terms.
So, we have a gun we can point at their heads?
Yes, sir, we sure do, Gant answered.
It might take them a month to figure it out, but they won't be able to run away from it for very long.
Okay, make sure State and the agency find this out. And, oh, tell CIA that they're supposed to get this stuff to me first. Intelligence estimates are their job.
They have an economics unit, but they're not all that good, Gant told the others.
No surprise. The smart people in this area work the street, or maybe academia. You can make more money at Harvard Business School than you can in government service.
And talent goes where the money is, Jack agreed.
Junior partners at medium-sized law firms made more than the president, which sometimes explained the sort of people who ended up here. Public service was supposed to be a sacrifice.
It was for him. Ryan had proven his ability to make money in the trading business, but for him service to his country had been learned from his father and at Quantico, long before he'd been seduced into the Central Intelligence Agency and then later tricked into the Oval Office.